Welcome, and thank you for joining us for Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Benefits and Insurance Professionals.
And I'm your host, David Saltzman, today to talk about all things short-term limited duration insurance. I have my buddy Scott Wham. Scott is Director of Compliance and Innovation at One Digital. He's also a former NABIP Ledge Chair. And most important of all, he is a fully fledged member of the NABIP All-Star Band. Welcome, Scott.
David, thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. So let's start with a level set, just in case there are folks who don't follow this particular part of the industry. What is STLDI?
STLDI stands for short-term limited duration insurance. Short-term limited duration insurance plans are plans that were intended to get people who might have been in a transitory state of life from point A to point B. Perhaps they were in between jobs, they couldn't afford COBRA premiums, maybe not have been eligible for subsidies through the health insurance marketplace, whether state-based or federal. And short-term limited duration insurance plans were viewed as a way to say, hey, this isn't a robust insurance policy, but it's something that's going to cover you for some catastrophic incidents if you encounter them through this period of transition. Since their advent, and when I say advent, I mean really in conjunction with the Affordable Care Act, because policies like this have existed for a long period of time before the ACA, but really just speaking about the post-ACA world. There has been a modicum of scrutiny afforded to these plans based on the fact that they are not generally robust insurance plans, and most consumers, when they buy them, walk in with eyes open that that's the case. But there has been a bit of concern regarding their impact on risk pools, their impact on the ACA markets generally. But high level, think about a short-term limited duration plan as a way to get from point A to point B, transition perhaps young people who are just out of school, who don't want to spend the money or don't have the money to spend for a major medical policy. That's the way to frame short-term limited duration programs.
So what we're talking about today is a change in the D part of it, right? It's in the durational part of it. What has it been traditionally, and what is it now becoming?
So traditionally, the period has ranged from a period of months to a few years, and most recently, following the Trump administration, the time period for short-term limited duration policies was extended to, I believe it was 3 years. 3 years you could enroll in a short-term limited duration policy, which I think when I saw that extension, my antenna went up and said, that feels like a long time for something that's called short-term. But now in the final rule that was just issued, we're back to a three-month standard to a true, very short window to get from point A to point B, 3 month window with the chance to extend it to a fourth month. So we've gone pretty significantly back from where the Trump administration had moved us to a three year time limit.
Yeah, because back a million years ago when I came into the business, it was 3 months and a month extension, and then it went to a year, and then it went back to three. But I don't think that was government regulated. I think that was just the way the carriers started, deciding to underwrite and charge the product. So let's go back to something that you mentioned parenthetically a moment ago, which is the whole risk pool and what the challenges are. Is this part of a bigger concern in the government about the entire risk pool that they've created?
Yes. Yeah, so anybody who's had a legislative role or has volunteered for days on the Hill in states that tend to be either purple or blue, just to use simple phrasing, have likely encountered conversations regarding a variety of plans that are sold alongside either small group ACA compliant plans or individual market plans. But let's just focus on the individual market plans for the sake of this conversation. There's an argument from proponents of the Affordable Care Act that I agree with conceptually, which is you have policies that have to comply with some pretty significant provisions, including essential health benefits, the elimination of annual and lifetime limits, the extraordinarily limited underwriting limited to gender, whether you smoke. And I'm sorry, it's not actually, it's gender blind now. It's limited to where you, whether you smoke, your zip code, and your age, right? So so very limited factors that go into underwriting ACA individual market plans. The concern from a lot of insurance commissioners that I spoke with over the years regarding this policy was if you allow short-term and limited duration plans, which are not considered minimum value plans under the ACA, they're not required to cover those buckets of essential health benefits. They are not subject to the same requirements from a from an out-of-pocket perspective. If you allow these policies to exist alongside ACA policies, is there a risk that healthy individuals who utilize less health care enroll in those policies at a rate that potentially undermines the stability of the ACA markets? We've experienced similar conversations regarding level funding. For those of you who work in the small group, mid-sized market, who talk about level funded products that are sold by carriers across the country, there's the same level of skepticism that applies to those plans in some of these states because they look at these as being potential risks to the stability of the broader insurance market. So the Biden administration taking a look at these policies and implementing this rule, reverting back to the world that you remember, David, of 3 months as being the standard, is not terribly surprising, given the type of conversations that, at least anecdotally, I've been having in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, over the past, gosh, 6 or 7 years regarding these policies. So I view this as an extension of that conversation of, hey, if we want to preserve the Affordable Care Act in its current form, perhaps we're going to limit the competition against those policies in the same risk pool.
It's fascinating. You know, I was just talking to somebody and they were asking about, you know, why all of a sudden is there all of this interest in these areas? And, you know, again, going in the Wayback Machine, but not that far back, we wouldn't even consider writing a self-funded plan on a group that was fewer than 400 lives, and then it went down to 300, and then it went down to 200 because, you know, actuarially, the folks providing the stop loss wanted some kind of big enough sample so that they could do their prognostications. But now we're writing self-funded plans down to smaller groups, and I think that was kind of the starting point of the small group level funded plans. It was like self-funding with training wheels, if you will, and maybe some golden handcuffs on the back, depending on the design. But are you hearing as much concern out of the administration and on the Hill about those kinds of plans, or is it so far mostly state conversations?
I'm hearing curiosity in those plans. And at the state level, I'm encountering perspectives beyond curiosity. I'm encountering open hostility. And look, again, I understand the theoretical underpinnings. As a consultant that works with small businesses, I'm going to bring the solutions that are available, right? If I'm working with a small company that has 30 employees and they have a great risk profile, of course, we're going to be talking about level funding in the markets that I serve because we have to, right? It's a solution that's available. But I am empathetic to the insurance carriers that participate in the ACA markets who have an issue with the cherry-picked risk, right? And the risk that's left over. It's a broad concern that I'm encountering is just this: how do we preserve the ACA market? I'm starting to see at the federal level more RFIs for perspectives on level funding than we saw maybe 6 years ago, you know, when they were first really starting to take off. Gosh, oh, actually 2014, it's almost 10 years now. Wow. Since I first started seeing. Oh, that just freaked me out, David. That that's been 10 years.
When you said 2014, and went, that can't be right. Oh crap, it is.
Yeah, that was 10 years ago. So this is common. And to throw one more variable in, some of you might remember when the Trump administration released the rules that I believe it was all the same package that addressed short term limited duration insurance policies and association health plans. Association health plans are another area of high skepticism in states that have robust ACA markets, because again, the premise behind an association health plan is to allow small businesses and individuals to pull together to pretend as if they're a large business. And the rule that was issued by the Trump administration was open season. You could form an association for any reason, right? Common industry, geography. We saw states step up and say, no, we're not allowing this legal fiction to go forward, that these are large employers that are going to pull good risk from the ACA markets. And I know there's a broad array of perspectives on this, but I'm just trying to articulate what the opposition was that I encountered in my home state of Pennsylvania, and I saw in the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast generally, was open hostility to the idea of allowing individuals and small businesses to aggregate together to enter the large group market where those market reform protections aren't applicable. And same type of hostility that we're encountering.
You know, it's interesting. Yeah, on the Medicare side, CMS has gone cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs about all of the marketing and how things are done. Has some of the concern that spawned these conversations and this change in the short-term laws, has it been around concerns about how they're marketed?
Yes, big time. There's been significant attention paid to how these policies are marketed. And I think that this is something that our membership and our industry has to wrestle with and acknowledge. And pretending as if this doesn't happen is not beneficial when you're trying to establish credibility with state insurance commissioners who are receiving reports from consumers regarding misleading statements made about short-term limited duration policies. Similarly with Medicare, that's how we got to where we are with having to record conversations and all of the new reforms in Medicare marketing. We have a lot of great people in NABIP who can speak to all the nuances of those Medicare rules, and I am not one of them. So I'll steer clear of that, but it's the same level of skepticism. You know, I'll give you an example. Just this past Saturday, I'm sitting at home, and this is a very common phone call I'm receiving on my cell phone, and I'm on do not call lists. I do not want to be telemarketed to, and I'm getting calls from robo dialers pretending to market, you know, Cigna, United Healthcare, major Buka plans, and saying, oh, we have a special access, and it's a number from Wichita, Kansas, that then routes me to some agent that's allegedly in Indiana but is really sitting in Oklahoma. And to pretend as if this doesn't exist is not beneficial to us, but rather to tell our story and how we do things responsibly to tell consumers the product, to educate consumers regarding the nuances of the products that they're purchasing. This is going to become a big issue. It already is. So the skepticism with short-term limited duration plans is that they're being positioned on the phone as more robust coverage than they actually are. And then when you sign the contract, the phone conversation never happened, right? So insurance commissioners are trying to walk a line where they're saying, hey, you know, we have to do something to protect consumers from predatory conversations that may be occurring within, you know, in my instance, the Commonwealth or your state, while respecting the fact that adults sign contracts, right? While respecting the fact that at the end of the day, a consumer puts their signature on a contract and they're expected to have read and had the chance to ask questions. But we know, any of you who run open enrollment meetings at work sites, the eternal struggle is getting people to read literature about the plan. It's not as easy as it may seem, and it's not as intuitive as we may hope. But all of this is, I say all of this just to give perspective on those of you who might have been disappointed about how we got to this rule of 3 months and with the ability of extending it to a fourth month, and who are upright brokers who do good work in this market segment. I'm just trying to give you the perspective that I'm encountering when this has come up at the state level over the past number of years.
Is this going to have any spillover effect in the market of these kinds of plans? I mean, will insurers pull back now?
I don't know. I still think that there's a robust market for individuals that are not high utilizers of healthcare to buy this transitory coverage. And I also think that it might even be more enticing for players to enter the market because the window's shorter. So if they sell individual ACA policies, they're not going to be cannibalizing their own book of business potentially for up to 3 years, you know? So perhaps there might be some who look at this and say, there's actually an opportunity here. There's actually an opportunity, but it's to be seen. I do think, though, that there is a good faith argument that these policies serve an important role in the market segments that we serve.
Given that the duration of the risk now is short term, is legitimately short term, 90 days or 120 days, Do you expect there to be any downward pressure on rates for these plans?
I would expect, I would hope that there would be some downward pressure, having that actuarial window of massive claims being incurred winnowed down to mere days. But again, that also signifies perhaps less premium coming in. So less time to offset larger claims. So it's to be seen, but I would hope that would be the case.
Any spillover on other plans that sometimes go with these, like hospital indemnity plans?
Yeah, so you and I, we were talking the other day about another strategy that was receiving some scrutiny. So I want to differentiate between the short-term limited duration plans and what have historically been tagged as MEC plans, minimum essential coverage plans. Just taking a step back, for any of you who work in the group market, this is 101 now, but any employer that averaged 50 or more full-time employees, including full-time equivalents during the preceding calendar year, is required to comply with the employer shared responsibility provisions of the Affordable Care Act. David, how many times do you think I've said that sentence?
Billions.
In my lines. Yeah, billions and billions. I love the Sagan quote, or the Johnny Carson quote of Carl Sagan. David, you're the man.
Just old and remember a lot of use.
Oh man, this is great. But so any company that meets that applicable large employer threshold has to comply with the employer shared responsibility provisions. There are two potential assessments at play under these rules. One colloquially you might have heard called the sledgehammer penalty, the 4980HA penalty, and then the 4980HB penalty is colloquially called the tack hammer penalty. In order to avoid that sledgehammer penalty, you got to offer minimum essential coverage of at least 95% of your full-time employees and dependent children up to age 26, or risk an excise tax penalty if one employee goes and gets a subsidy. Okay. So in order to offer minimum essential coverage, historically, employers would go to insurance carriers. In the market segment I serve, I know you got the reference-based pricing folks out there. I love reference-based pricing. Don't jump down my throat because I'm going to reference the BUCAs, right? But historically, most small to mid-sized companies would go to a BUCA carrier, say, hey, I need to put a plan in place, and they would attempt to comply with the law. The challenge, though, and this is a real challenge that I hope the Biden administration considers, and we had conversation with them regarding this challenge, but there's a real challenge that occurs for employers, especially the first time they cross into the ALE territory and become subject to this law, where they are dependent on a carrier being interested in their risk, right? In order to comply with offering minimum essential coverage and avoiding the sledgehammer penalty, let alone offering a minimum value plan that would get you out of the tack hammer penalty, and that plan has to be affordable for the offer of minimum value single coverage while satisfying the dependent coverage requirements as well. So forget about minimum essential coverage. To offer a minimum value plan from a traditional carrier, they have to be interested in your risk. And what I've encountered countless times, right, is companies where before they became subject to the law were not in a position to offer robust coverage, but yet they're not in a position to be able to afford extreme excise taxes. So they go to the carrier in good faith looking for a policy, but because of whatever reason, it might be their risk profile is terrible, right? They might be a more mature population. They might have a ton of waivers that are not considered valid waivers. They might have super low income earners who don't qualify for Medicaid, right? And they're not going to and they're in a gap for subsidized coverage. So for whatever reason, they're bad risk, and the carrier can issue them a quote that says essentially, we don't want your business, right? We're going to issue a quote because we have to. We're going to issue a quote, but that quote is going to be, we're not interested. Mm. And if that occurs, there's been few options for employers to turn to in order to avoid potential penalty liability. We have a new one in ICHRAs, and that's a whole nother conversation. Yeah. That hasn't historically existed, that's relatively developing and out there, and there are many NABIT members who are involved. That's a strategy that exists. But there was another strategy that was developed to serve a very specific purpose, which was building what are called minimum essential coverage plans. They were sold by carriers that none of us had really ever heard of before, but they were creative, and they came up with these policies that were an analog to a short-term limited duration insurance policy, right? They're not going to cover the market reform requirements of the ACA. They're super skinny. When they're positioned, they have to be positioned appropriately as, hey, these are not real insurance policies. They're not what you would think of if you were to buy a major medical plan. This is really to protect the company and give you a modicum of protection. And those policies were paired with hospital indemnity plans, where if they had some type of hospital charge, they would receive that fixed rate back in a reimbursement. And this was a really useful tool because the carriers that would sell these policies would offer a MEC plan where they have a price structure set up that employers would pay. And because those MEC plans don't pay a lot out in claims, they were able to then offer a minimum value plan design above that that would get them out of the B penalty. And the whole thing is built on low participation in the minimum value plan. Not because it's forced, it's just we know that about the group going into it based on the buying behaviors of their employee populations, right? This is a strategy that is a fallback position for an employer that's attempting to avoid penalties, right? To avoid penalties. The administration shares a similar concern about this strategy that they share to short-term limited duration plans, which is, how are these policies being positioned? Are they being positioned as non-insurance? Are they being sold as major medical insurance, and then they buy the plan and they realize it's not real coverage? We were fortunate enough to be able to have our day in court. They didn't address this in the final rule. They were considering it in the final rule, but they didn't address it. We were able to have our day in court, and we said, look, there is no relief for a company from ACA excise taxes if they have an unhealthy population. And there's no guarantee that employer has the margins in order to care for that unhealthy population. Like, that's not a guarantee in every company that they can subsidize the cost to an effective level to avoid excise taxes. This is the only strategy that they have at times. Now they have ICHRAs, right? And ICHRAs are another strategy, but ICHRAs have a detail where, you know, affordability is based off a silver level plan in the individual market, not a bronze level plan. So it's actually a little bit of a higher bar to get over. But there's ways of really utilizing that in these types of situations as well. But it's an essential tool. If that tool goes away, there are companies that are in verticals like home healthcare, temporary staffing agencies, restaurants, right, that have high turnover and low participation historically in plans that would have a very difficult time navigating the employer shared responsibility provisions without paying excise taxes. It's important to remember, though, that I think the employer shared responsibility provisions are an appropriate term for this because it's not actually a mandate, right? A lot of times it's called the employer mandate. It doesn't require specific performance. Employers can choose, do I want to pay excise taxes or do I want to offer affordable benefits? And if this strategy goes away, I think you'd see more employers in those verticals considering just paying the excise taxes. And I don't think anybody wins in that scenario. I don't think there's any winner in that scenario. So this is another area that we're going to have to pay attention to. It's another area that's on the radar, and it's concerning to me a little bit.
So we've got a couple of minutes left. Kind of our crystal ball question: what do you see that we need to be, besides that we need to be aware of, that's percolating between the administration and the Hill and the various regulatory agencies? What's kind of on the horizon that you're looking at?
So I think that they're super focused on PBMs, right? I think that the cost of prescription drugs is coming to a head. Everyone at this point who's a member of this association should be familiar with the Johnson & Johnson lawsuit that was brought against Johnson & Johnson as plan sponsors for a breach of fiduciary duty, an alleged breach of fiduciary duty, for failing to appropriately manage their prescription drug costs. Now, I'm not saying that lawsuit is going to be successful. I think Johnson & Johnson is going to have an argument that's process-based that could get them to a position of even a summary judgment or a dismissal, should I say, a dismissal. But let's just put that aside and say the plaintiffs are successful. This is going to put a lot of pressure on plan sponsors. And in order for plan sponsors, especially, again, in the market segments that the average NABIP consultant is serving, a lot of those employers don't have internal expertise necessary to navigate keeping PBMs honest. You know, they don't have the clout to get the access to the reporting that a lot of larger companies have. And I think that the Biden administration, and then even, you know, let's say Trump wins the election and the Trump administration comes in, I think this conversation continues. I think the scrutiny of how can we put some parameters around PBMs to have some level of check in their pricing practices. The challenge, though, is as an association, having conversations about price controls is difficult. It's a difficult thing to have because when you start picking stakeholders to target for price controls, what's to stop that cannon from pointing back at you? We all believe in our value proposition. So do the stakeholders who are fighting to defend the status quo. They believe in their value proposition as well. So it's going to be a slog. But I think that the focus on prescription drugs is going to be one that we have to pay attention to. I also think that there's going to be another push, you know, given the politics. Let's say there's another repeal and replace effort. I think that what concerned me about the repeal and replace effort back in 2017 was that it was a reconciliation bill that can only impact certain aspects of the Affordable Care Act. My concern is with targeting the Affordable Care Act in a limited fashion. If you were going to target the Affordable Care Act, could have unintended consequences of collapsing markets as opposed to improving markets. For instance, if you have an insurance market that prohibits medical underwriting for pre-existing conditions, it's easy to draw a straight line to the logic of an individual mandate, right? And that, again, was a provision that was taken from the Massachusetts healthcare law passed under Mitt Romney. And the economic sense behind that is logical, at least in my estimation, where if you can't deny people coverage when they walk in the door with cancer, you need as many people in the risk pool as possible. Repealing that individual mandate was a destabilizing variable. Now, I know there's a lot of opinions here, but I don't think we get a lot of pushback from those who even supported repealing the individual mandate that was a destabilizing measure. So my concern is, big picture, and this is a big one, David, probably another conversation for another day, but my big concern is if you pull the wrong peg with the Affordable Care Act, you're delusional if you think we're going back to 2007. You're delusional if you think we're going back to pre-ACA. The next stop will be single payer. The next stop will be a conversation about, hey, ACA, we tried to have a private public partnership. We tried to do it, didn't work. Next stop will be a serious conversation about single payer public option. And none of us want to get there. So we have to be very thoughtful. These are things that are on the horizon. Is Congress going to do anything right now? Likely not. Election year. Are they going to do anything next year? Maybe not if it's divided government. Who knows? But these are the items that I'm paying closest attention to.
And I think that's a great place to end our conversation for today, at least. And then we'll come back and talk about some of these other things as we move along. Scott Wham, Director of Compliance and Innovation for One Digital. Scott, thanks so much for sharing your expertise.
David, this has been fun. Thank you for having me.
You can have the Healthcare Happy Hour podcast downloaded automatically by subscribing on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also find a link to the podcast in the member-exclusive Washington Update, published on Fridays. For more information on our government affairs efforts or to become a member, visit nabip.org.